Welcome everyone to The Art of Advisory. My name is Hector Garcia with Quick Bookkeeping, and I'm joined by my co-host Kirk Bowman from Art of Value. Hey Kirk, how are you?
I'm doing good, Hector. How are you?
Very good. Excited about having Phil Jones as a guest. I'll introduce him real quick. Let's just make sure that he's on. Hey Phil, are you connected? Can you hear us?
Hey Hector, I hear you live and clear. A pleasure to be here.
Okay, that's perfect. All right, so Phil Jones, or Phil M. Jones, is authors have to have middle names. That's very important. Phil M. Jones is the author of two books that I have holding in my hand. One is called Exactly What to Say, which is one of my favorite books that I've read in the last couple of years. It's a bestseller in Amazon, I believe under the category of consumer behavior. So maybe we'll dig into that, Phil. It's a number one bestseller under consumer behavior. It's a 120-130 page book. You can read it within an hour. I read it within an hour, but I go back to it consistently because it's just a sort of a great reference book about word choice. And as an advisor, word choice is really important. So we'll dig into that. And his other book that I have here is called Exactly How to Sell, which is a good continuation of the book. It talks a little bit about word choices, but it really does talk about sort of the art of salesmanship and the importance of creating rapport and building a relationship, what to do exactly during the sales process and after the sales process, and really what the purpose of the salesperson is. So Phil Jones, from his biography, has been a business owner for a very young age, got into sales pretty early, then became a sales manager, the youngest sales manager in the company that he was in. And now he's an author and a sales trainer turned keynote speaker, speaks everywhere about sales training. Phil, was that a good characterization of you in the current state?
Yeah, I suppose that'll do so just fine, Hector. And I think to add to that, really, I've had a passion for helping people navigate the decision-making process my whole entire life, and enjoy now seeing the satisfaction of passing on some of those skills to other people so that they can find more confidence in their conversation, getting people to steer themselves towards the outcomes that are right for both parties more often.
That's great, Phil. So let's jump right into it. So it looks like you kind of have a franchise going here. You have two books back to back with the word exactly right at the beginning, exactly what to say and exactly how to sell. So obviously that word must mean something to you. So I would love to ask you why the word exactly, why is that so important to you?
I think one of the things in my world that occurs a lot is people get taught principles, people get taught strategies, people get introduced to ideas of how they can do things that can make them more successful. And during that introduction of that idea or strategy or principle, people nod and smile and say, I get it, I understand. And then they find themselves back in their real world and they say, yeah, but what exactly do I do? What is the precise action step that I should put into practice in order for me to be able to get the results that I'm looking for? And they're looking for clarity. People like to be told what to do and then find their own experience within the precision of that strategy. So I like to write precise how-to books. And I like the word exactly because there's just some solidarity in it. It's not like, kind of, or something like. It's that'll do. And the irony is that the more fences that you build around stuff, the more you actually constrict people into saying this is the precise way to be able to do things, the more freedom they then often go on to be able to find to bring their own experience towards that exact strategy that then creates the uniqueness.
Plus, it's very intentional, right? I think intentionality comes across your writing quite often, right? Where it's, you want to be purposeful, you want to have a particular goal in mind, and you want to execute. So I think the word exactly exudes that. So let's jump right into it. So Exactly What to Say. It's a book that contains about 25 phrases that if you adopt them, and I'm sure a lot of people already use them and maybe subconsciously, it's really effective and they don't know it. But the phraseology and the phrases and the words that you choose, especially when you're selling your idea, selling a product, or selling yourself, right? Whatever situation you may be in, because I believe we're all salesmen at heart, because we all have to sell something, right? If we want to communicate it properly. I want to talk about some of those key words that help us not only sell a product, but sell an idea. So can we go down the road in some of those key words that you really like in terms of building rapport and selling to our customers?
Yeah, I guess we can jump in with one of the first sets of the examples from the book. But before I do so, I think one of the important things for us all to consider, and everybody listening in right now, is that the worst time to think about the thing you're going to say is in the very moment in which you're saying it. And as professional service providers, quite often what we find ourselves in is conversations that are remarkably repetitive, that we have clients ask the same questions of us. We find ourselves in the same meeting time and time and time again, that we are not in this ever-changing environment that sometimes we try and convince ourselves in. And I can prove that down to the fact that I would imagine that everybody listening to this show right now has on their computer, their laptop, their desktop, their Dropbox folder, a number of templated documents they utilize to be able to create better experiences for their clients so they don't have to write everything from scratch every time. I'd encourage people to have sequences of words that they use in vocabulary that have that same level of flexibility that says, I've pre-considered what this conversation might look to be able to go like. Now let's look into something that could work specifically or exactly towards any of your audience's circumstances. Is I would imagine that everybody listening to this right now has got products or services or advisory services they'd like more of their clients or more of their prospects to be able to consider. Not necessarily buy, but find themselves in a conversation that they can have a meaningful chat about whether or not the advisory service they'd like to be provided would fit for that given individual. Yet brokering that conversation and getting a point to it being a serious conversation can be challenging. It's like, how do I fit it in? How do I get it into a conversation? People quite often don't ask for the things that they want in life because they're fearful of rejection. So I figure that if I can help people structure rejection-free openings to conversations, they can find themselves having more open discussions about the kind of products and services that they'd like to be able to chat with people around. So a simple sequence of words, some of the magic words I lift from exactly what to say, would be a way of introducing just about anything to just about anybody completely rejection-free. And the words in question are the words, I'm not sure if it's for you, but. See, if I introduce an idea to somebody and I say, I'm not sure if it's for you, little voice inside head does a couple of things. First thing it does is it says, I'll be the judge of that. The second thing little voice does is curiosity is piqued and it's like, what is it? What is it that you want to be able to talk to me about? So I have to be able to find out some more. There's some further power in this sequence of words though, which is the insertion of the word but. See, what the word but does in almost every given conversation is it negates what was said prior. I mean, imagine a set of circumstances where a client was saying to you, like, I really value the time, effort, and energy you've put towards our business since its incubation, since it started back in 2007. But things have changed. You know where the conversation is now going. But what's happened is they're saying, I forgot all the good stuff you've done. I'm sorry you're fired. That's the likelihood of where that conversation is going to go. So, but negates everything that came prior to it. I'd avoid using it at all costs other than this precise set of circumstances. So if I now to say to somebody, I'm not sure if it's for you, but how would you feel about working with me more closely on a one-to-one basis to help me partner with the success of your business? Well, about the only thing the other person can say back is well, how does that work then? So that would be one example of a precise set of words that can get us into a more meaningful conversation. Now, another is all built upon the fact that a really simple human principle. If I asked a room of 1,000 people who would see themselves as being open-minded, how many hands do we think would go up?
All of them.
Yeah, like somewhere like most of them, other than the people who wouldn't raise their hand regardless of what I asked. And there's a belief that everybody wants to see themselves as open-minded. Because what is the alternative to open-minded?
Close-minded, right?
Now, that's the accountant in you that says the alternative to open-minded is close-minded, being as precise as you possibly can. Yet the true alternative to open-minded is almost like idiot. Like, you cannot admit to not being open-minded. It's a difficult thing to be able to admit to. So I can use that fact in language. I could say, look, how open-minded would you be to us working more closely together on the success of your business? Now, if I ask a how open-minded question would you be, it's very easy for me to introduce an idea to somebody that cannot change.
If you don't mind, Phil, this is fantastic stuff. This is from your book. And actually, those two were probably the ones that created the most conversation between people in my office. We were discussing, you know, these kind of techniques. But kind of the counter argument to this, especially among folks that are not traditionally in sales, right? Accountants, accounting professionals, that sort of thing, is, you know, this is salesmanship. You know, I'm not a salesperson. As a matter of fact, I believe that most accountants probably pride themselves in how far away from a salesperson they are in terms of, let's say, what the public stigma is of a salesperson. So I would love for you to convince accountants, introverts, people that have high trust with their customers because they're not salespeople, in why is it important to kind of behave like a salesperson, and what really does it mean to be a salesperson?
Let me come at this a slightly different way. Is you've got a picture, an image in your mind right now of a stereotypical salesperson, yes? Throw some adjectives at me, some describing words that would describe that stereotypical salesperson to me.
Sleazy, pushy, persuasive, sneaky.
Right. See, the image you see in your mind's eye right now, the image almost every accountant sees when they think the word salesperson, is that same picture that you just saw. What if, by alternative, I don't ask you to describe a stereotypical salesperson, but instead I ask you to describe a professional salesperson? How do the adjectives now change?
Well, the word professional implies that they do this for a living. So they would be methodical for sure, possibly knowledgeable, a knowledgeable, experienced, somebody that connects with the audience, understands the customer. I mean, the word professional most of the times evokes that, for me anyway.
So why is it in that set of circumstances that you now see something in your mind's eye that's remarkably different? See, I've just changed one word and you changed them all. And when we move from stereotypical to professional, you conjure up a completely different vision. So my thing that I would ask more people to consider is that being a salesperson isn't a bad thing. What your perception of what a salesperson is might well be the bad thing. We all need salespeople in our life to be able to lead decisions. The best sales professionals in this world take responsibility for other people's decisions, helping them to achieve outcomes that are better than the ones that those people could have achieved by themselves. That's what great sales professionals would do. Gone are the days where somebody can say, he's such a great salesperson, he can sell sand to Arabs. Like, because if you sell sand to Arabs, like, how does the Arab feel the next day? Like, when surrounded by sand, it's like, this was the wrong thing for me to be able to buy. What would be more considerate is an understanding of being able to help that person make a decision that was right for them long term. So as professionals within the accountancy world, our customers don't know what they need to buy from us. How many of our customers are experienced buyers of advisory accountancy services? Like, next to none of them. So if you're going to sit and wait for the phone to ring and wait for somebody to say, please, can I buy your advisory service? Expect you and your family to go hungry. If what we want to be able to do is to introduce an idea to somebody that we believe might be better for them than what they currently know exists, that's us taking responsibility and being experts. Now, this means that the primary difference is the integrity of the idea that we're looking to be able to introduce. We have to know enough about the other person to believe that the idea we're going to introduce to them can truly deliver value. Do you know what that means? It means we have to care. It means we have to truly care about the outcomes that we're looking to be able to achieve. It means that you move from being able to say that what I have is I have a cookie cutter service that says I'm going to do a tax return and I'm going to do your annual account and I can stay on top of your payroll and I can keep your books for you and there's fixed price, fixed price, fixed price, knowing that then your primary thing for you to be able to differentiate with competition on is twofold. Primary is price. Second is convenience. They're the only two things that you have that you can lean on. The minute you shift towards an advisory model, what you have is the ability to say, this is the thing that makes us demonstrably different. This is how I can stand alongside you, in front of you, and behind you, with your business goals at the front of my mind, using the knowledge and experience that I have to navigate a part of your business success that you don't hold the experience in. It means that you have to be prepared to be results focused, outcome focused, and the outcome changes. This is what I ask everybody to consider in the sales profession. If you want to move towards the professional position, you have to change the finish line. Now, if you are selling wedding dresses, what is the most important day?
The wedding day, right?
Right. So it doesn't matter about the day you go for your first fitting. It doesn't matter about the day that you swipe your credit card. It doesn't matter about the day that they cut the fabric. It doesn't matter about the day that they fit the veil. The day that matters most, and if that day works well, everything else becomes inconsidered, is the wedding day. Now, if you're selling wedding dresses and you have the mindset of the fact that the wedding day is the day that matters, the day you swipe the credit card isn't the day you celebrate. You celebrate with the bride and groom 2 weeks after the wedding day when they come back and show you the photos and the dress looked wonderful and they were elated and they got a day full of compliments. That's the day you celebrate. So if you want to be a professional advisor within the accountancy space, what we should be not doing is selling our packages, our bundles, our products or services or anything with a dollar amount attached to it. We should be looking to align ourselves as true partners towards the outcome that that client is looking to be able to achieve in the future. So if, for example, you find out the plans of your client is to open 3 more locations, take on 5 new members of staff and create an automated accountancy system that means that they can extrapolate themselves from the business, putting themselves into a situation where they can be more of a chairperson and less hands-on within the day-to-day, guess what happens is that becomes your job. So you do the work that you need to do to help support them. That means that you can chink glasses with them 3 years down the track when you say, look, we conjured this up in my office. This was an idea that you shared with me, and then together we've achieved it. That's the day you celebrate. Not the day you raise the invoice, not the day that you process the transaction into QuickBooks, not the day they pay the bill, but the day you achieve the outcome. That's where I think the biggest shift comes in becoming professional, is the moving of the finish line. So I know I've just gone on a little angry rant for a while, but I don't know if that answered your question.
That's brilliant. We'll let Kirk jump in. That's brilliant, Phil. Yeah, thanks.
So Phil, I just consider that a warm-up because I spend a lot of time helping accounting professionals start thinking about, let's transition from the what, the tax return, the bookkeeping service, whatever, to the why. What is the result the customer's seeking? And so I love the fact that you're focused on the outcome, because ultimately, if we don't get to that point, we have failed as a professional, in my opinion. What is one of the things regarding language that you found is very effective to helping transition the conversation early from the what to the why, to the outcome?
So much of effective conversation is about permission. It's about earning the right to be able to talk about the thing that you want to be able to talk about. So a simple pivot at the early part of a conversation when meeting a new client for the first time might be a question that is something along the lines of, what do you understand about the different levels of service provided within the CPA industry? Now, if I ask that question at the get-go of meeting a new client for the very first time, what do you think the majority of clients are going to say back?
Well, they're going to list out the what's most likely in bullet points.
Yeah. And realizing that that is a bad answer, what the majority of people then may well say is, well, I know that some accountants just do this, this, and this, but in truth, I don't really know. I don't know the difference. Now, the minute somebody holds their hands up and says, I don't know, who's established themselves as the expert in the conversation?
Well, certainly the customer has relinquished that to the professional.
Right. Which you can then now map out the different types of levels of service that exist within the industry. So you could say, for example, well, what there are some accountants that offer fee for service. They have open, transparent pricing towards the exact thing that they do, and they will work to get that thing completed in the shortest period of time to add to the efficiencies of their organization. And they will be thinking about completing the task, not necessarily the results and outcomes of your business. What there are then is strategic advisors that sit at the very top end of the business advice spectrum, charging tens of thousands of dollars on a per day basis in order to be able to then support those large organizations to navigate themselves towards strong corporate success. And then there are a number of us professionals that sit somewhere in the middle of between those two spectrums that become genuine strategic advisors to independent businesses across the United States that don't just complete all the necessary analytical paperwork. They also have your back thinking about the long-term success of the organization. So given those three different types of accountancy service that could provide, where do you see yourself fitting in the kind of service that you would require?
So you give the customer an opportunity to self-select by giving them three options. Where have I heard that before, Hector?
You know, I wanted to jump in on that, Phil, if you don't mind. I've recently had a conversation with someone in LinkedIn that was trying to put down the whole concept of, giving the three prices and the three tiers under the argument that we should be, as professionals, we should be able to be good enough to offer the one thing that the customer needs. But okay. Phil, I would love to know from your perspective, what is the importance of giving customer choices?
Well, note what I've just suggested there. I've given a choice of three options, but only one of those options is me. So I haven't said, here are three options you can choose from me. I've said, do you want the organization that can do you quick and dirty tax returns? Do you want a strategic advisor who runs alongside your business and charges your fortune to be able to do so? Or do you want a genuine long-term partner? Okay, so I've given them the perception of choice. And that's a very, very different thing. Now, what we could then do is if we have an understanding that our workload differs within that singular choice, we could then provide further choices at that level. And we could have a bronze, silver, and gold if we choose to within our business model. Yet the challenge in doing so is sometimes the other person doesn't know how to be able to select within those choices. I might have a bronze, silver, and gold if I said, for example, if it is small business under three employees that requires X, Y, and Z, it's this price. And if you're a business between 5 and 25 employees with a turnover of this, et cetera, is at this price because there is more work involved. And if you're at this price, you know, at this size, then there's more. The trouble with that is, though, is you're presenting yourself as a generalist, yet you want to earn the credibility of being a specialist. Now, if you wanted to open a can of beans, the last thing you would ask somebody for is a Swiss Army knife. Yet a Swiss Army knife will do the job just well enough. If you want to open a can of beans, you want a can opener. Back this up a little when you're thinking about how you want to build your business, particularly an advisory-based business, is typically a smallish organization, single person, maybe with an assistant, maybe a small group of accountants. What we're not looking at is a giant organization. Is a mistake that most people make is they don't realize that as sales professionals, you have a right to choose your clients. You don't have to accept everybody that the phone rings. And what the majority of people do is they say, I'm open for business. This is the service that we provide. And they accept everybody that turns up. Big difference between sales and marketing is that what marketeers do is they try and get bees around a honeypot. They say the honey's so sweet, let's hope some bees turn up. Now, when the bees turn up, they have no control over who those bees are. And I'd imagine so many people listening into this podcast right now, if they think about their clients they've had through the years, they've got one or two they wish they didn't have. Now, when you look at the ones that you wish you didn't have, are those clients that you strategically hunted down and said, I'd love to do more business with people like you, or are they people that just turned up one day? What great salespeople do by alternative is they choose their clients. They have a picture in their mind to say, these are the people that I work with, and they're prepared to say no to the ones that don't fit. So my advice towards anybody looking to build a long-term advisory business is to make sure they have clarity over who the people are that they serve. If you are serving all of the people all the time, you cannot be an expert advisor because you're a generalist. If you're a generalist, you cannot command premium fees. In Exactly How to Sell, we write about the importance of understanding that you are X for Y and that you have this clear at the front end. So you can be a certified professional accountant. How does a client know that you're the right fit for them? But if you're a certified professional accountant for independent dental practices, guess what every independent dental practice thinks? I'm an independent dental practice and you deal with accounts just for dentists? Well, you could be a good fit for me.
I thought you were pausing there. I don't want to interrupt you. Go ahead and finish and I'll ask you a follow-up question to that.
Yeah, and I think regardless of where you see that little niche, that niche kind of play out for you, is it becomes really quite liberating. One thing I don't tell that many people is I used to own an independent property business. We did most of our work through the independent financial advisor networks. And in our best year, we turned over £240 million. Now, in our second best year, we turned over £80 million. And there's a big difference between those two numbers. 240 million to 80 million is like a third of the number. The biggest change that we made in our best year ever was that we became overseas investment property experts for dentists. We didn't become overseas investment property experts for everybody. It allowed us to be able to narrow our gaze, decide where we go fishing for more leads. We would turn up to the dental expos showcasing our investment properties where everybody else was selling drills and new chairs and wonderful new Invisalign treatments and new fillings and veneers, etc. And we're like, hey, how about a place in the sun that brings you a return on investment? We're the only people there. at the Investment Property Expos, we were surrounded by thousands of other people offering what seemed to be a very similar product or service, where differentiation was hard. The minute we became X4Y, a path opened up, and guess what happened is we became referable within that niche. We became talked about within that niche. See, so many certified professional accountants right now, the only way you can be referred is if somebody says, I'm looking for an accountant, which very few people say. Whereas if what you do is that you can lock down within a specific industry, provide a specific service towards that industry, you can build an enviable reputation. And what I would ask yourself to do is to decide today how many clients you really need. How many clients paying what? You're probably going to find out it's a number that's far smaller than you thought it was. And once you lock in and say, what does my business look like when it's full? When I found all of my missing people? When I've got clarity over who the clients are that I'd love to serve? You can then concentrate your efforts on serving those clients. The challenge that most people have when they build an advisory-led business is they still focus all of their efforts on winning clients. If too much of your efforts is focused on winning clients and growing business, then your effort in your brain and in your heart isn't spent on delivering the advisory service that you promised, the result of which is you let your clients down.
That is so true. I mean, most of us accounting professionals, we do get excited about a new sale. We get excited about bringing a new client, but we don't get excited about occupying 20% of our time to get new clients. And what you're saying is, and this is sort of a linguistic trick, right? Becoming X for Y, it's a very definite statement that you have to make and become the part of your marketing, part of who you are, part of your business, part of your name, part of how you introduce yourself. So if you're going to become the cloud accountant for plumbers in Florida, right?
Yeah.
Very specific. And if you were to, you know, sort of do a business search, how many businesses are there in the United States that I can serve? Let's say it's 20 million, but that looks attractive. How many, small plumbers in Florida are there that are willing to go to cloud accounting? Well, probably 100. You know, most folks get so caught up with, if I specialize, I'm limiting myself. If I specialize, I'm creating a ceiling. If I specialize, I'm narrowing my market. But that's not really true, is it?
It's not true at all. And the way I try and describe this is if you had a bow and an arrow, right? The reason the arrow is effective in the bow and arrow concoction is for two reasons. One is the tip of the arrow, and two is the weight of the arrow, right? And the force that's then propelled behind it. Many accountants have the weight and the force already in place. They have their experience, they have their expertise, they have their credentials, they have their software, they have their team, etc. They have all of the weight to be able to deliver solutions towards a multitude of problems. But without the tip, they cannot pierce a new market. Having the tip of saying that I'm X for Y allows you to be able to market with more effectiveness. Now, when we did this in the dental industry, guess what would happen? People would say to me, like, I'm a chiropractor. I know you specialized in dentists, but it sounds like this could be a good fit for me. Is that okay? You say, yeah, sure. They say, I'm not a dentist, but I've got a property portfolio in the UK and the overseas thing sounds like a good idea. Can you work with us? And we'd say, yeah, sure. It doesn't become exclusive. It gives you something to aim at. The way that I describe this in my seminars is if you were to play the game of darts, you know that maximum score when you're playing the game of darts is triple 20, right? It's landing the dart inside the triple 20 slot, getting 60 points every time you aim. But if you're anything like me, I aim at triple 20. Every time I play darts, I hit it about 1 in 100. I miss most times. But the fact that I was aiming at triple 20 on the dartboard means that every time I missed, I still contributed towards my score. I get a 7, a 14, a 21, an 11. If I wasn't aiming at treble 20, I might not have hit the board. Could have hit the barmaid, the floor, the ceiling, the window. But every time I aimed at treble 20, I contributed towards my score. The exact same thing is true with getting clarity over who it is that you're aiming for. Every time you shoot, you might miss. Every time you shoot, you might miss. But 6 years on from now, if you do this all day, every day, you'd look at your client bank and you'd think, well, these are largely all the people I love to do business with. And your reputation is built within that space. As a generalist, you are very replaceable.
It's interesting, Phil. I think if I had to summarize what we've talked about so far, primarily, you essentially say language matters, whether it's considering the words that you're going to use with the customer, whether it's using the words that you're going to use to describe your specialty. And by the way, I love the words you chose. In this case, you know, you drew from math X for Y, right? But that's very memorable, and it's kind of a mental hook. But language matters. What was it that happened in your experience that made you wake up and realize language does really matter?
There's a couple of things, really. Is one was I was in a senior leadership position from a ridiculously early age. So I was 18, running teams full of salespeople, multi-million dollar businesses. And you get prejudged pretty badly in that environment. Surrounded by experienced people that are looking at you thinking, who the hell are you, you little kid? So you learn real quick that you have to earn respect. You can't just demand respect. And it meant that I had to study the success of other people if I was to contribute towards that success or share that success with others. And one thing I learned from studying some of the best salespeople earlier on in my career is that the biggest difference between those that were crushing it and those that did just fine wasn't just hard work and endeavor and product knowledge and skill set and care and love and empathy and compassion and all those other ingredients that, you know, are important. The kicker of influence and difference was the people that were crushing it. They knew exactly what to say, when to say it, and how to make it count. They knew the power of the right words at the right time. And they built systems of those words that allowed them to be efficient in the use of those words, driving not only an improvement in conversion, but in a speed of transaction as well. This fascinated me, and it had me looking at it and saying, how many patterns occur in this piece? The reason that I work in the world of sales and influence is I'm lazy. I like to find the shortest and easiest and most efficient way of finding success. And lubricating conversations, helping other people make decisions more quickly, more easily, if done with integrity and heart, is the fastest way to be able to become more successful. So I like puzzles, and the puzzles created through the decision-making process is my hobby. So I've studied those words, I've studied those conversations, and I get great joy out of making other people's train sets run faster through changing a word or two.
I like how you've taken kind of the idea of applying processes to a business and applying it to language, right? These idea of templates. Because one of the things that I get in some of the seminars that I teach is kind of this question of, and you alluded to it earlier, this idea of people can learn something, but then applying it to their specific situation is another leap for them. And so you talked about how the word exactly in your book title really is trying to help draw people into that. And essentially, taking the idea of systems and applying it to language means, yes, you can go into an unknown situation, but be confident and have some certainty because you're taking in tools with you.
You got it. And I was back in the UK recently on a little vacation, and we were sat on the beach. So I was watching a guy teach somebody to surf. Now, teaching somebody to surf, I think, has to be one of the hardest things to instruct somebody to be able to do for the very first time, right? You're needing to balance on a moving object with a moving floor, with the balance of nature throwing in and the predetermined vision in your own mind that other people are watching you make a fool of yourself. So educating somebody through that process, I think, is masterful. I was watching the guy instruct, and what he did is he told people exactly what they need to do. Put that foot there, put that foot there, stand in this precise little position, etc. And guess what happened is the minute they followed those precise instructions, they were surfing. They weren't good at surfing. They were surfing. Now, the fact that they've now gone from I can't do this to I'm doing it, the growth curve in experience is now abundant. Now that they've got themselves in the game, becomes a lifetime of skill and experience to get yourself on the podium. And I think that's what things like precise sequences of words allow you to be able to do. They give you the confidence to get into the conversation the first time. They work really well to a point, but mastery then comes in the decades that follow.
It's interesting how you're taking this idea and saying, you know what, it's kind of simple to apply it to language. Mm-hmm. And it's, in other words, you know, we talk so much about the mindset of doing, but I think there's a mindset to learning. And I noticed that you're applying a mindset of, I can learn this. And how are you doing that? It's through the word choice. And so that's literally what we're bringing into the conversation with a customer is we are bringing choice of language to help them decide, which in my decision, deciding is simply a more specific process of learning, right? Because when the customer is having a conversation, what they're trying to learn is, are you the right fit for me, and how can I get to a better outcome by working?
Right. And I think shifting the outcome of some of your conversations is important too. Is if more of the advisory-led accountancy practices could change their thought process going in, saying that my objective isn't to sell them my services. My objective is to help them make the right decision as to whether my services are the right fit for them. That change of thought process allows you to be able to bring your full self towards that conversation. Also, let go of the fact that if they choose to not pick you, it's not a problem. There's no issue. It's just the fact that you did the work to find out if there is a fit. If there's a fit, we'll do the next piece of work. If there's no fit, we'll steer them towards something that might be a better fit for them. And guess what happens? That's how professionals work. What we also then want to consider is some principles that can help people have more of those effective conversations. And the first thing that we do need to consider is who is the person who's in control of every conversation? And the person who's in control of every conversation is the one who's asking the questions. Most professionals, particularly in an accountancy background, they get asked a question by a potential client and they think, I know this one. I know the answer. And they feel obligated to give an answer because that's how they get to feel smart. That's what they did through school. That's what they did through life. It's like, I know answers to questions. I'm smart. What they really should be thinking is, how do I lead this conversation towards the outcome that I'm looking for them to be able to discover? So when client asks questions, we might want to regain conversation and regain control of that conversation by asking a question back in the other direction. So they say, well, look, how much do you charge? We might say, well, look, before I go there, like, what do you understand about the different types of services that accountants can provide? Now we're back into steering the conversation. Understand this as a simple rule of thumb, is that questions start conversations. Conversations build relationships. Relationships create opportunities, and opportunities lead to sales. You've got to do the whole dance if you want long-term success.
Can you repeat that, Phil? Repeat that,
please. Yeah. So questions create conversations. Conversations build relationships. Relationships become opportunities, and only those opportunities become sales. A mistake that so many people make is they think that if I embellish my product and service with a beautiful number of features and benefits, then other people will buy it because I made it sound great. It's not true. Like, if you turned up to a first date with a resume of all the things that make you brilliant and said, "Should we get married?" You'd be an idiot. Instead, what we do is we know we have to do the dance with the other person to get them to fall in love with us. It's questions that create conversations, that build relationships, that create opportunities that lead to sales. You want to make more sales? Ask more questions of the people that you'd love to date. And by date, I don't mean go out with for dinner and drinks. I mean to see if you can flirt with each other to a point that you decide that doing business over a sustained period of time is worth it. The business model of advisory becomes profitable year 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That's where the real success in the business model comes, is when the relationship is sticky enough that they feel like you care. And they feel like you care because you do care. And they know that you've got their back, and that what can happen is a quick email or a quick text message can deliver them tens of thousands of dollars worth of value back to their unique set of circumstances because you've done the groundwork. Just like a friend, family member, or loved one that you've done the groundwork with, you get efficiencies out of that relationship that you couldn't get from elsewhere. That's the value that advisors should be bringing to their clients if they truly want this business model to work for them. Don't think about the recurring revenue year one. Think about the recurring revenue year 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, should you be managing to be able to build these relationships that are honest and true enough.
Absolutely. No, you reap what you sow, 100%. Phil, there was something that you mentioned earlier, and we're similar age. I'm in my late 30s, and I assume you are too.
I like to call it mid-30s still.
Mid-30s, okay. and I started as a very young age. And one of my own problem, you know, the one that I brought to the table is, you know, I look young. I look younger than what I am. On top of that, you know, I don't have the gray hair. I may not have the experience. I don't appear to be the typical advisor. And because of that, I'm going to have a challenge getting the advisory work. And I made the mistake of trying to prove myself by making statements that prove yourself. And that turned out to work a few times in a sort of gimmicky way. But when I started learning that great conversation happens not when you talk about yourself, when the both people conversate and have a dialogue around the issue at hand and their goals, that's kind of the great equalizer. I found that no matter how old you are and how much experience you have or don't have, and or skills have and don't have, conversation is the great equalizer. It's the one tool that all of us, I mean, everybody can speak around the same tone, around the same length, use the same words. In your entire book, there are no like big words, you know, like ubiquitous is not there. And every business book has the word ubiquitous. You don't have it, right? Because you're not trying to prove that language is about vocabulary. I think you're trying to prove that language is about connection to the conscious and the subconscious. And there's something that you say that I think I really like, which is, and I'm going to rephrase it and you obviously correct me, that something needs to feel right before it makes sense. Or what yeah. is it you say? Yeah, it's actually, I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, understanding the decision-making process, the emotion always comes before logic. And I ask audiences are full of people is, do people make decisions on emotion or logic? And most people jump to the fact that they believe decisions are emotive. They're not only emotive. It's just emotion comes first. Something has to feel right before it makes sense. And I want us to think about maybe some other areas of this of our lives to prove that this is true. Is if, are you married? So the day...
Phil, just to fill you in, I'm married and I got 4 kids.
Okay.
So that's a sounding yes.
Yeah, that's a very strong yes. So the day you asked the question of your wife, did she meet your multi-point inspection checklist of what you were looking for in a partner?
No, it was all emotional.
That's right. A trick question. That's not fair.
Well, no, I think it's an honest question we look at. And the reason I want to play it out is that in the moment, it feels right, right? The emotion is the thing that triggers the decision, yet the logic that then comes afterwards. And the reason that I use the marriage example is it's unlikely that you propose and get married on the same day. Highly unlikely that those two things happen. So proposal happens, which is because it felt right at the moment in time. The logic kicks into place following that proposal of like, am I sure I want to do this? That is then the happening in that engaged period of time. So logic comes after emotion. The time that we can put into place to be able to say, how do we make this feel right for our client to be able to choose this, is way more valuable than the argument of it making sense. And I think I phrase this in the book in a real simple way, or at least I try to, is when you meet with a client, are you looking to help the person or fix the problem? And the majority of accountants that I've met jump straight towards the I can fix the problem. Now, you cannot fix the problem until you've been into a position that you can help the person first. So you cannot help the person until you understand what that person really needs. So the first step should be, let's put the time in to get to understand who's the person on the other side of the table, what their objectives are, what their challenges are, what their obstacles are, who they are, what they're about, at which point you've then earned the right to be able to then provide the logical argument of why you're the number one choice. And it leads towards my definition of what selling really is. Selling is earning the right to make a recommendation. That is what my definition is selling is earning the right to make a recommendation. What that means is that you should never, ever, 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 ever invite somebody to buy something unless you can say these words first. And the words I think you should be able to say first are the words, because of the fact that you said. Because of the fact that you said A, B, and C, it's for those reasons I'd recommend X, Y, and Z. Now that would play out like, because of the fact that you said that you've got some big aspirations for this organization and you'd like to grow and build a financial stable model that gives you the capacity for growth. For those reasons, I recommend that we work together, not on a typical accountancy fee for tax return type service, is that we work towards my advisory model, giving you the support of long-term advice, having somebody strategically aligned for the size of your business. And what you talked about, Hector, was a challenge that came down to the perhaps that some of the people who are adopting cloud-based software, some of the people who are adopting this advisory model are perhaps younger in the industry more so than those that are more senior. and they're scared about that peer pressure or scared about that preconceived idea of the fact that they might not see or look like they are credible enough to be able to then stand out at the top of this marketplace, we just need a question. Question pre-handles that objection is, how much longer do you see yourself in business? Well, I'm building this out for the next 25 years. Now answer me this, would you rather work with the same strategic advisor, the same person that sits alongside you throughout that journey, or would you be looking to change that person a number of times? Well, I'd like to work with the same person for continuity of care all the way through my business success. So wouldn't it make sense that you work with somebody who is young and hungry and aspirational about finding that success alongside you? And as it stands and probability tells you right now, is going to be around for at least that length of time too? I go, yeah, that would make sense.
Brilliant. That's brilliant.
But every objection we're scared of getting is avoidable with a question, not a series of statements that embellish our brilliance, a question that helps them see the same thing that we're seeing.
And in your book, if you only got about 10 minutes left, and Kirk's going to close it up with the last question. In your book, there's a couple of other magic words that I'd like to plug in here. This is from Exactly What to Say. Where you, and I'm gonna say a couple, and then I'll let you kind of just talk through them, because I know you're good at doing the long answers. So we have the if-then strategy. So I would love you to talk about it. And then the one that says, how would you feel or how will you feel? And I think you can tie those two together pretty well.
All right, let's play with those. So if-then is a preconceived subconscious program that exists in our mind from childhood. What happened is that parents, loved ones, carers, people of seniority gave us a variety of pieces of data with the if-then formula to the point that we now believe if-then in almost any given set of circumstances. If you don't eat all your dinner, then you're not going to get any dessert. If you don't study hard, then you're going to get bad grades at school. If you don't spend the time phoning your grandma, then she's not going to leave you any money in the will. Like all those examples of if-then, we had learned to be able to believe that if that thing happens, then that is the outcome. It means that that programming allows us to be able to create other sets of examples with if-then that can support us in business conversations. If you put your trust in me as your advisor, then I promise you won't be disappointed. Okay, that's easy. If you move towards cloud-based software for your accountancy, then you'll get those shelves back in your office at home that your wife can be able to utilize for those beautiful ornaments and photographs that you want. If you decide to be able to move towards the advisory service, then what you get is somebody who feels like a business partner in your organization without taking any of the equity. See how we can create if-then examples that all of a sudden mean that if we want somebody to believe something to be true, we take an if followed by an action with a then followed by an outcome. It means that they then grow confident in taking the action that you'd like them to be able to do. And there's dozens of examples where people can use that. I've littered a few in so that people can start playing that formula to find their own set of words.
And that's how you learn how to discover what's valuable to them, right? Because the then is the valuable part. The if is, you know, you're going to pay for our services. So, right. I mean, what you're saying is it's obviously more detailed version. Yeah. If you pay our services, you will get this value, right?
Right, but because of the way that formula is put together, the belief in the outcome becomes stronger than the fear of the action. So what happens is it builds confidence. What needs to happen for that to work with truth attached to it is you have to have done enough consultation to believe the action that you're about to ask them to make is the right action for them. And the then has to talk towards a precise outcome that you know is true to their unique set of circumstances. So if we can get to work on this advisory service starting on from today, then 12 months on from now, then what you'll have is an accurate set of accounts that allows you to forecast more effectively, that puts you in more control of the decisions that you're going to make for 2019. Okay, I need that. I need transparency and control. I feel like we're running blind right now. Okay. And what I've done is I've put a 12-month solution in place that says I'm going to earn the respect of being able to win this business. So the if-then formula can work towards any set of circumstances. It just has to be true. And for it to be true, you have to have a discovery phase in questioning first. Otherwise, what you're doing is guessing. And guessing is a dangerous place. So back to the marriage example, is the day that you asked your wife to marry you, how certain were you she was going to say yes?
95%. Right. But not 100%. But not 100%.
Yeah. South of certain, but a high level of confidence to a point of pretty darn probable. It's the same level of certain.
101%.
You waited too long.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And there's a reason behind that, because she made me wait too long to go out. So, you know, payback's a, you heard that phrase. So anyway,
pro quo, right?
Yeah. There you go. So Phil, one of the things that we like to share with the audience is some early advice that you got that really sets you on a trajectory. And I like to ask it this way. What's the best business advice you've ever received?
I've received so much great advice through the years. And I'm going to give two things in this answer. One is, I think, an answer that helps give clarity to the question. And the advice I got is that there is a big difference between advice and opinion. Understand the difference. So everybody is willing to be able to give you their opinion. Don't always read it as advice. It might not be. They might not be coming from a position of experience, authority, or understanding on the words that they're giving to you. So take advice from trusted sources, not opinions from others. The biggest piece of advice, though, that I think I've learned is I learned third hand through listening to a set of CDs or tapes, I think, back at the time from a Zig Ziglar program. And Zig said that the key to greatness is to find a way to serve the many, for service to many leads to greatness. And that just rings around in my head. Find a way to serve the many. Find a way to serve the many. The success in this world has nothing to do with you. It has everything to do with the number of people you help. So get busy helping people and that success finds you as a byproduct. Chase success, you become an egotistical maniac.
That's great, Phil. So we'll like to wrap it up. So the two books that you have out, I don't know if you have more, so I'll let you answer that. It's Exactly What to Say by Phil M. Jones. You have to use, he's an author, so you have to use the middle initial. That's the rule. And I love this book. What I like about this is it's not a storyline. It's not sequential per se. You can actually pick it up at any page and then you get something from it because it's really just sort of like 25 phrases, and I think you covered about five of them, and kind of like some examples on how using them applies in the real world and how helpful they can be. And I'd like to say one thing, though, because I like to read Amazon reviews that are one star, Phil, and I read yours. Yeah. I always do that. There's something weird or strange about, like, when I buy a book, I've always looked at a book needs to have 4.5 stars, you know, for it to be attractive. And I'm always reading the one-star reviews. And
you don't know is Hector is the one that writes one-star reviews too.
I've 17
just profile. Brushing up on it.
I've done it. I've done it. Not for yours though. And some of the things that it's just so strange. Some of the things that people write is it's too short, not enough meat in it. And wasn't this the point? You know, making it short so people can read.
I care about reviews and I care about the impact that I have on the world. And back to the point that I made, which was to find a way to serve the many, we got hundreds of thousands of people that take huge value from that book. But I think the other big acceptance is that you can't please all of the people all of the time. Quite often when you get negative responses in this world, it isn't because of the fact you did anything wrong. It's because that person had individual things going on in their world on that day and you happened to be in their way. So I also believe that the products or services that have lovers and haters are way better than products that are liked by most people. Think about music as a goal is, you know, there are people that love the Rolling Stones and people that hate the Rolling Stones, and Mick Jagger loves them both.
And isn't that part of a strong positioning? If you have strong positioning and you don't have people that don't like what you do or they're against what you do,
I think the missing point also is Peter Parker once said, with great power becomes great responsibility, right? So Spider-Man quote. And the kind of work that I do, and in a book titled Exactly What to Say, it could very easily position itself into a way that people could consider it as manipulation, unethical, starting to steer people towards outcomes that aren't right. And if you just pick up the 15,000 words in the book and read that without any understanding of me or my work or my heart in terms of where I'm coming from, if you view that book through the lens of saying, you know, how is this going to be used for evil? Then sure, you could take that and run with it. If you look and say, how can I use this to be more helpful, to be able to lubricate more success for my clients and have them having more effective conversations, then you'll get it for its intention. But judge it by the wrong set of standards, it will miss.
And bottom line, successful people entrepreneurs, CEOs, politicians. They get to where they get there because they chose the right words at the right time that got them the outcome they were looking for. That's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love writing the book. I love hearing from people that have impacted success within the book. The reason you and I are talking today is because you stumbled across the book. And my passion is people like your audience. I love all the people in this world who are good at something and that they do good for their clients, but they fail to get the results that they're capable of getting because they haven't been trained to effectively navigate the conversations. And the result of them failing to be able to effectively navigate their conversations is their competitors, who don't offer anywhere near the level of service and support that they do, clean up and win their business and steal the success from the families of real life people in this world. That if those people could just learn to be able to demonstrate their value proposition and ask for money with more confidence, then the world would be a better place and I go to work for those people.
And the second book I talked about was exactly How to Sell, which I like to describe as a potpourri of sales tips. It's also not very sequential per se. You can open it up at any chapter and there will be all sorts of useful sales tips, which again, you could take some, not take others. I mean, I read almost the entire book. I just got it a couple of days ago. And there was one thing I got that it's something that already rattled my head, which is the importance of a single handwritten note. And if you have time, where did you get that idea from? It sounds so obvious, but it really isn't. You know, how many handwritten notes do people get and why are they important?
Well, I think there's two things. One is if you want to be seen as different to your competitors, then you have to behave and act in a slightly different way. You can't just say that you're different and be the same. And if I read the majority of professional services websites, everybody says that our difference is our service. So if everybody says that our difference is our service, nobody has any difference. Where did I get the idea from? Is when I first started my workshop business 11 years ago, I wanted to say thank you to the people who supported, put trust in me and attended my seminars. I wanted to say thank you in a way that was sincere and heartfelt. They didn't pay a huge amount of money for their ticket. I didn't have a huge amount of budget to be able to say thank you to them. Couldn't afford to be able to send them gifts, and gifts would have seemed impersonal. Gifts would have seemed overly elaborate, and gifts would have seemed like I was trying to compromise for something. So I thought, I'll just send them a note. I started sending notes to people. People started to enjoy those notes and would comment back and reach back out to me and say, thank you for the note. And it started to build more influential relationships. And I learned more of things that could come as a result of sending handwritten notes. Is I learned that if it was a card and not a flat piece of paper, people would value it more. I don't know why folded paper is more valuable than flat paper. The minute paper is folded and in a position of card, people are like, this really means something. They put it up, they showcase it, they tell the world. I also learned that if you put a card in a colored envelope rather than in a white envelope and you handwrite the envelope, the likelihood of it being opened quickly is significantly higher than any other means of communication. So in a world of digital transformation where everything is email and text message and automated and impersonal, we have a tool at our disposal that costs less than a buck a time to be able to communicate with somebody, that shows that we care, that has a level of personality to it, that has to be considered words because of the limitations of the space that's available to you and the strength and power in your wrist, that cannot fail to show that you care. Why would we not utilize such an effective means of communication when its risk is close to zero, its effort is minimal, and its return potential is so paramount? For me, it's a no-brainer.
That's brilliant. And that really sums up the body of your work. So other than the two books that you can find on Amazon, you have a website, anywhere else people can learn about you?
Yeah, I mean, website's a great place to start. Go find me across all the social channels on from there. I think one thing I'd love more people to know about, and even if they're live right now, they might want to comment, is the 30th of August is I am performing a full-day sales seminar as a one-of-a-kind one-day piece in New York City in partnership with Audible. And this is going to be an Audible original. It's called How to Persuade and Get Paid. It's the sales workshop for everybody. People in the accountancy practices would hugely benefit from being there. It's that kind of person that I wrote the program for. And if people can be in New York City on the 30th and want to be in the live studio, well, the live theater audience for the live recording, and comment in the Facebook stream and tag me, I will happily invite them as VIP guests at no charge to themselves.
Oh, that's great. So Phil, I'll post your website and the links to your book in the comment section on Facebook. Thank you very much, Kirk. You want to have any last parting words?
Phil, I enjoyed listening to your British accent for an hour, and thank you that it actually had some value to it as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the surprise and the fact that the accent was more than there was something there too as well.
Bye, guys.